from NPR and WBUR. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And I'm Lisa Mullins. It's Here and Now. The U.S. economy added 103,000 jobs in March, according to numbers out today from the Labor Department. The unemployment rate stays put at 4.1%, where it's been for 6 months now. The number marks 90 consecutive months of job growth in the U.S., and that is an all-time record. Joining us to talk about that record now is Ali Velshi, MSNBC's anchor and economics correspondent. He's also co-host of Velshi and Rule. Ali, thanks for being here.
Thanks, Lisa.
The increase in jobs last month is less than expected and a lot less than in the month of February.
Yep.
That's when there were 313,000 new jobs. Why was the number of jobs created lower?
Well, it's always hard to tell in the immediate aftermath of the result, the release of these numbers. But part of the issue is that the unemployment number, as you've said, has remained at 4.1%. And traditionally, economists think of 5% as full employment. So once you get down to lower numbers, there's not as many people to put into these new jobs. So we've got a bunch of things at play here. We have a number of unemployed people in the United States and a number of job openings, but we have stopped being able to match the unemployed people to the job openings, which may mean that we're in a bit of a static place for a while.
Another month with a steady unemployment rate, 4.1%, the lowest since the year 2000. Is that a kind of natural floor for the jobless rate, or can it go lower?
It can go lower. What tends to happen is as the jobless rate goes lower, wages tend to increase. So that tends to be the pressure on those things. But yeah, it's possible that it can go lower. I think over the long term, we probably expect it to stay in this area and even possibly increase as we get more automation into our economy over the next 10 or 15 years. But this is as low as it's been for a long time. Typically, when it's this low, you start to see wages going higher. We've only seen a bit of that so far.
Yeah, let's talk about that. Wages grew 2.7% over last year. But once again, that doesn't really seem to be growing as quickly as one might think in such a tight labor market. How come?
Yeah, so the good news is 2.7% is higher than the rate of inflation, right? You want to be getting a bigger raise than inflation is taking a bite out of. But, you know, it's kind of a standoff between employers and employees right now. Who's going to blink first? At some point, when we stay at these low rates, 4.1%, we keep on creating jobs, employers are going to have to pay people more than they're paying them now. So a lot of economists say that sometime in the course of this year, we'll start to see those raises increasing.
It's always worth noting that this report is a snapshot of the economy, which seems pretty strong right now. When we look at the stock market, we aren't always, though, seeing a clear reflection of the economy.
Right. And really, over the last 15 or 20 years, we've seen the stock market decouple from the economy. The unemployment number tends to be one of the best reflections of the economy. And we've got a pretty good economy. That doesn't help those people who are really, really having trouble getting jobs. But this is a pretty good indication of a pretty good economy. The stock market is reacting to a lot of other things right now. So we've seen, you know, we've had a rough first quarter in the market. At this point, that is disconnected because most Americans have jobs, or at least 70% of all Americans have jobs, whereas only half of all Americans own stocks. And many people who own stocks don't hold them actively. They're part of a 401k that they maybe check a few times a year.
One industry that added jobs was manufacturing, up 22,000 in March. That, as China and the U.S. appear to be edging closer to a trade war. Don't know if it's going to happen or not, but what effect could that have on manufacturing?
Well, that's obviously a positive. We've seen manufactured goods increase over the last decade, but we haven't actually seen routine increases in the number of manufacturing jobs. The Obama administration and now the Trump administration have a big push on exporting. Some of this has to do with the fact that the U.S. dollar has been a little bit lower, making it more attractive for people around the world to buy American-made goods. But that's yet to be seen. It's hard to sort of get a trend out of a month. It's yet to be seen whether these manufacturing jobs continue to increase.
Okay, very quickly, are economists seeing any other clouds on the horizon, inflation, for instance?
Only from the wages. The increase in wages are the only real threat to inflation. We're not seeing higher oil prices or energy prices. So for now, we're keeping a close eye on that. But, you know, the inflation that people accept is when they're getting a wage. They don't mind that as much.
Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent. Nice to speak with you.
My pleasure.
Well, this weekend, the Prime Minister of Hungary will try to win a third consecutive term. Viktor Orban is admired by Europe's far right for his anti-migrant policies, which include building a fence along Hungary's southern border and refusing to take in migrants under the European Union's quota system. He has called immigration the Trojan horse of terrorism and positioned himself as a defender of white Christian Europe. NPR's Soraya Sahardi-Nelson joins us now from Budapest. And Soraya, is it safe to say that immigration is the issue for Hungarians going to the polls this weekend?
Well, certainly that's the issue that the prime minister would have his constituents believe is the main one. He's very concerned not just about the large numbers that came across 3 years ago, but that they're Muslim, the fact that they are going to colonize Hungary and the rest of Europe, and that he is the sole defender, as you mentioned earlier.
But right now there is not currently a problem with immigrants coming into the country. Isn't that right?
Yes. In fact, it's very strictly controlled at the moment. So only two are coming in each day. I discovered this on a recent reporting trip. We're talking about migrants who arrive without papers or mm-hmm. who are seeking asylum. So it really isn't an issue. And in fact, Hungary is not a place that these migrants have gone. They wanted to go north, whether it's to Scandinavia or Germany or west to France, and not here, basically. And so you really don't even have migrants here. And in fact, this is something the opposition raises as a red herring that's being brought up by the government.
So in the last 8 years, Orban's government has rewritten the constitution. It's overhauled the justice system. It's also clamped down on free press. So just tell us more about his leadership style.
Well, the analysts I've spoken to say that it's all about winning for him. He really took it personally when he lost an election some years back. And so it's very important for him to win. And he's decided that embracing this sort of right wing or far right tone and agenda is the way to do it. And to sort of establish himself as an autocrat and his government in a very autocratic manner, that this is the way that he can ensure that this will never, that a loss will never happen again.
Is he popular?
Yes and no. I mean, clearly he is winning, and elections are monitored here. How free and fair they are is increasingly being contested. He does command some respect, and xenophobia has played well here, like mm-hmm. it has in much of Europe. And so, what he's been doing, though, this year that's a little bit different, is he's now added the American billionaire George Soros, who is a Hungarian-born billionaire and philanthropist who's done a lot with democracy-building NGOs. That's something he's done all across the former Soviet bloc here.
Prominent liberal,
elsewhere.
Too, we should point out.
Yes. So this man has become sort of the boogeyman, if you will, for Viktor Orban and his Fidesz party and the government. And so he's basically saying that the migration problem that's happening is all because of this, the fact that George Soros is trying to bring in these people, that he's trying to overthrow the government here and overthrow democracy. And there, in fact, was a UN committee report that just came out in recent days that talks about or that warns that Hungary is really tackling or attacking democracy and that it really should stop this attack on George Soros.
Well, what about the opposition? I understand that any of his opponents may have been hobbled by something that the prime minister's party did back in 2011 with political districts. Is there a viable opposition that can confront him?
Well, they're very fractured. Certainly the redistricting or gerrymandering, depending on how you look at it, was a problem. Also, Viktor Orban and his government have increasingly taken over the media here in terms of especially radio, which is really important, and television. Nobody can get on. In fact, the opposition was limited to 5 minutes, basically, in the last 4 years, not just during the campaign season, to be on air.
Wow.
And present their side of things. And so it's really problematic. But the other issue is that it's very hard for the opposition to come together. They don't really trust one another. There was one exception, though, in a town in southern Hungary called Hudmozoy Vasorhe, which is translates to Beaverfield Marketplace. This little town with 44,000, which is a Fidesz stronghold. I mean, this is a place where Viktor Orban's party just has never lost. Their mayoral candidate ended up losing, the Fidesz party's mayoral candidate, to an independent candidate that was, in fact, backed by all the opposition. And what they did is the other parties didn't field their own candidate. They all went behind this guy, and he won with a very clear margin.
Soraya, the rise of the far right all across Europe has been something that people have been paying very close attention to. What is Viktor Orban's relationship with the EU? I understand he's a fierce critic of the bloc, but he's eager to take their money.
Yes, indeed. Hungary is one of the largest recipients of European Union money that is paid out, and that doesn't seem to be getting any less. But there have also been allegations by Transparency International and other watchdog groups that this money is not being spent properly and, in fact, is going into graft and questionable projects and that sort of thing. But what Viktor Orban wants, he does not want Europe to have a say over countries. I mean, he would prefer that the money perhaps flow, but that countries retain their sovereignty and that there is just less control from Brussels. And so he's been a very strong advocate. If he ends up winning this election on Sunday, as is predicted, the feeling is that he's just going to step up those efforts.
NPR's Soraya Sahardi-Nelson speaking with us from Budapest. Soraya, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Composer and musician Bill Frisell has a new album, and last week it hit number one on the Billboard Jazz Chart. It's called Music Is, a riff on the phrase music is good. Bill Frisell is known for his collaborations with Elvis Costello, Paul Simon, the LA Philharmonic, but this time around, he's flying solo. He plays every instrument. Music Is contains a blend of Frisell's earlier works and new compositions. Here's one of the new pieces, Change in the Air. Bill Frisell is in Athens, Georgia, where he's now on tour. Bill Frisell, you've appeared on more than 250 albums, over 40 albums as a band leader, but you don't go solo on many of the albums. Why?
Well, that's been a challenge for me to play alone. From the first moment I picked up a guitar, there was this social aspect with, you know, I've always been a shy person and awkward, but with the guitar, it was like this magic wand that seemed to bring everyone together. And so all along, the guitar has been about interacting with other people. It's never been, I know there's, you know, there's this, the tradition or whatever with a, especially with a singer-songwriter, the lone troubadour or whatever, you know, but it's something that's sort of hanging out there in front of me that I try to, I'm just trying to get it together to be able to do that. You know, like when I was in school, I had to take a speech class. That, like, talk about a nightmare situation.
If you could only have had an instrument with you.
Yeah. I mean,
to do the talking.
As long as I've got that in my hands, then everything is cool.
So then why another solo album? I mean, were you trying to kind of force yourself into your peak discomfort level?
I don't want to make it sound like that either. It's because over the years, it's become just another aspect of what I do. I mean, the first time I tried to do a solo concert was in the early 80s. I tried to play something alone, and it was really just so uncomfortable, and it was a drag. And I swore I'd never do it again, but then I thought, no, I got to get this together. So a year later, I tried it again, and then it kept getting better, and after a certain point, it was like, wow, I can actually do this. And it started to feel like music.
Well, this seems like a right time to talk about Thankful. So on a song like this, what comes first, the notes, or it sounds backwards, the inspiration for the notes, because you say it's a tribute to the musicians that you've played with, and your wife and your daughter too?
Usually it's just a melody, just a very simple, you know, I'm saying I'm writing it, but then, like, one thing that happened on this album, there's this song that begins and ends, I think I call it Pretty Stars, and then Made to Shine at the end. That was something I quote-unquote wrote.
These are the songs that bookend the album, Pretty Stars and then Made to Shine at the end.
When I wrote it, I recognized that it was a very, very common chord sequence. Prior to the recording of this album, I was playing at this club called The Stone in New York, and I was playing some of the music that I would record, and so I played that song, and a guy at the club one night, he said, oh, I love, that was a really great version of Jesse James. And I thought, what? What are you talking about? I don't know any song called Jesse James. And he played me this recording, and I was like, oh my God, that's the same. It's almost the exact same melody. And then I checked it out, and it was like, you know, it's just an old traditional song. Like, I probably heard the Kingston Trio play it when I was 5 years old or something.
Oh, sounds like a lawsuit in the making.
Yeah, and I could be in trouble now. But I think it's a, you know, it's like a public domain kind of a thing. And then there's so much music floating around. I don't know where it comes from, whether I'm writing it or am I remembering it or what is it?
Let's listen to a little bit of Pretty Stars. I'd love it if you talk about track four, which is What Do You Want? Let's listen to some of it.
Okay. Yeah, what you're hearing right now is just one chord that I played on the guitar that was captured, frozen, and sustained, and then that went through some other processing. So there's sort of a drone, just one sound that was originally from the guitar, and then that's going through like a vibrato pedal. I think that's all it really, it's kind of a that shaking sound. And then I'm using that as the backdrop for just this one solo clean guitar sound. But what you heard at the very beginning is just one chord that I played on the guitar that was sustained, and then that went through some other processing. And there I'm messing with it some more.
What are you doing there?
It's like if you had a tape, you recorded something, and then you played it back at a different speed or something.
Now, that was the end of the song. How did you decide to end it there?
That's, you know, I was trying to stay in this state of not being sure what was going to happen.
You mean as you're playing it or composing?
Yeah. Well, the composing is, you know, I'll have these melodies or pieces. They never feel like they're finished anyway. But what I did to prepare for the album was I actually played six nights at the Stone in New York. Every night I brought in a pile of music and I tried to play things that I wasn't familiar with, either old compositions of mine or new ones. And I tried to keep myself just off balance for that whole week. And that's what I wanted to continue on into the studio. I didn't want to have it all figured out, like mapped out what was going to happen. I didn't know what instrument I was going to play. I didn't really know anything when I went in there.
You know, for somebody who, it sounds like you would, in your younger days, hide behind your instrument, that takes a lot of confidence to now go in and not know where you're going to end up and put yourself in a strange or unusual or difficult, uncomfortable place intentionally.
Well, but that's when the stuff really happens. I mean, that's the thing about music. It's like when you're dreaming and you jump off a cliff and you just start flying. And that's the best feeling with music for me, is when you can take these chances. But I say jumping off a cliff, but like, what's going to happen if you play a wrong note? Well, okay, you know, you get all the thrill, but you don't get banged up too much.
What song would you like us to go out on here?
There's that one, Monica Jane, which I wrote for my daughter. First time I recorded that song was just about a month after she was born. It was my first trip being away from her. I went to Oslo to record with Paul Blay and Paul Motion and John Sermon, and I had this song but no title, and we played the song and Paul Motion said, "It sounds like your daughter, you know, you should name that after." So that's where that song came from, 32 years ago now, more.
Bill Frisell, thank you so much. The album is beautiful. It's called Music Is. Really nice to talk to you.
Oh, you too. Thanks so much for listening and checking out the music. I really appreciate that.
I've got to warn you, this next story is probably going to stay with you for a while. A foul odor has been wafting over the town of Parrish, Alabama. Mayor Heather Hall spoke to WVTM-TV.
Once it gets warm here, it's going to be terrible if that stuff is still here. So we're going to do everything we can to fight to get it out.
That stuff is tons of treated sewage inside dozens of train cars from New York and New Jersey. All of it was bound for a nearby landfill, but the cars haven't moved in months. Dennis Pillion has the good fortune, I guess, of covering this story for AL.com. And Dennis, one person called it the smell of death. I'm sure you've been out talking to residents living near this rail yard. What are they telling you?
I have. Well, clearly nobody is happy with the situation. This is actually the second rail yard that they have tried to use for this operation. They've kind of been chased out of one town already, and now they're into their second setup at a rail yard. So, and the complaints are still coming.
Here's what I don't understand about this story. Why is that train coming from New Jersey in the first place? Why doesn't New Jersey just deal with its own problem?
Well, it's New York and New Jersey, really the New York City metropolitan area. And once upon a time, New York City, they used to just haul all that material offshore and dump it in the ocean. EPA told them they can't do that anymore, so they've been looking for other places to put it, and that includes landfills in upstate New York. They've been shipping it to Colorado, and for a little more than a year now, they've been shipping it to this landfill in Alabama.
Wow. So let's be clear here. The sewage will go into a water treatment plant. It will be treated. And then it's the leftovers after it's been treated that we're talking about? That's what's sitting in the train?
Yes, it's the solid material. They call it sludge. They call it biosolids. There's several different names for it.
So this landfill in Alabama, Big Sky Environmental, owns it. What have they said, and what is the plan to move that train out of the neighborhood?
Well, the town officials at the town of Parrish kind of gave the landfill an ultimatum. You know, they said, because originally they were not, you know, raising a stink, forgive the pun. But
sure. Why not? We had to do it.
had to. But, you know, originally town officials, they didn't think this was going to be a big deal. You know, they thought the rail yard was in a spot where the odors wouldn't travel. They didn't think it was going to be as many train cars as it turned out to be. But obviously they got a little bit more than they bargained for. So the town has given an ultimatum to the landfill to move the cars by a certain date, which has come and gone this week. The cars are still sitting there. So now I think that the town is evaluating their options and seeing what they can do about this, which frankly may not be much.
Is anyone worried about health concerns? I mean, people getting sick.
So mostly the concerns are about odors. We haven't seen any reports of people getting sick. You know, these biosolids are created by wastewater treatment plants all over the civilized world. And, a lot of that stuff might be closer to you than you'd like to think about.
Yeah. Dennis Pillion covers natural resources for AL.com. Dennis, I hope they give you a new story soon. But thanks for covering
this one. I
hope so. This
one's starting to get a little funky.
Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg will testify before Congress next week about his company's handling of user data. This after outrage over the revelation that tens of millions of Americans had their data harvested for political purposes. Some members of Congress want to regulate Facebook. Regulations are already being imposed in Europe. The EU will implement strict new privacy laws next month. Internet companies have enjoyed minimal regulation here in the U.S., but that framework has recently changed. Business reporter Alina Selyuk can explain why. She covers the tech industry for NPR. Alina, let's start with the broad regulations on the internet. Lawmakers have curtailed part of a provision at the foundation of how internet companies do business. It's called Section 230. What is it? What was it? Why has it been changed?
Sure. So Section 230, and it lives in the Communications Decency Act of all places, it essentially enshrines into law this approach that we've had to internet companies, which is to say they're platforms and they're not publishers, which is a really huge debate with Facebook, right? Is Facebook a neutral, open pipeline for all ideas from everyone, or is Facebook kind of like a media company that's more of a publisher of content? And what Section 230 does, it gives companies like Facebook this major legal shield to avoid liability for what people say on their platform. So when I post something on Facebook and it's defamatory, Facebook is not responsible for that posting because Facebook gets treated like a platform. And this law got changed earlier this year specifically to deal with one type of content that does take place on the internet, which is adult services ads and specifically sex trafficking of children. So it kind of goes into the direction of a very specific crime that lawmakers were trying to curb on the internet. And in order to curb sex trafficking of children, they went and amended slightly Section 230 to make internet companies more legally responsible for that type of content that takes place on their platforms.
Now, Facebook itself seems to have conceded that it is a publisher to some extent and is taking actions now to limit what users and advertisers can say online. Here's Facebook's chief operating officer, Sheryl Sandberg, who was speaking on Morning Edition earlier today.
We're trying to have very good community standards. We're open about what those community standards are all around the world, and we're going to get increasingly open about this. We want to make sure people understand, you know, there's no place for terrorism. There's no place for hate. There's no place for bullying.
Is Facebook trying to regulate itself so the U.S. government might not get involved?
I mean, this is a tactic that is sort of defensive and offensive at the same time. In this moment, we're looking at a whole series of changes that Facebook has announced since we started talking about fake news and Russian propaganda, and now this disclosure of the use of user data for political purposes. They earlier this year announced that the news feed, which is sort of the main way that you experience Facebook as a user, now will display friends rather than news stories. That was their reaction to the fake news outcry. Now they're letting users review en masse all of the apps that have access to their data in an organized page in one location. So they are making changes in a way that allows them to say, look, we are adjusting, we are adapting, we're hearing your concerns, we're reacting to these negative stories.
Meanwhile, if you can contrast that to what's happening in Europe, the European Union is going to impose the strictest privacy rules in the world in May. What would those regulations do?
Right. So May 25th is the date when the European privacy rules go into effect, and they run a whole gamut of various restrictions of what internet companies can do with your data. For instance, it requires parental permission for minors under 16 to even be on a website like Facebook. And more fundamentally, there's this explicit requirement for getting an agreement from the user to even allow access to their data. So that has led to a massive wave of companies like Facebook rewriting their consent agreements. For the first time, I think the reason they're doing this is because eventually they might face fines, financial burdens for violating these rules.
Final question, Alina. Even if the U.S. Congress tried to regulate Facebook, there are some who say, look, they don't understand individual congresspeople, the technology well enough to do that effectively. Is there any merit to that?
I think any kind of law on this topic will go through years and years and years of debate. I think the major moment we are experiencing now is that people like Mark Zuckerberg are coming out and saying, you know what, maybe we should be regulated. So I think we will see a big movement. It's just a question of how long it will take.
Thank you. NPR business reporter Alina Selyuk, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
A new study published this week in the journal Health Affairs lays out another benefit to eating well. Patients with chronic illnesses were delivered specially prepared healthy meals for an average of 2 years, and researchers found those patients needed less health care over that time. We're joined now by Megan Thielking. She's a reporter at our partner STAT, the Health and Medicine publication. Megan, tell us more about this study.
Yeah, so the study was run in partnership with this Boston-based nonprofit called Community Servings that delivers medically tailored meals to patients with chronic conditions. So they might have high blood pressure, or they might have liver disease, or they might even be patients with cancer, or some combination. And so their diets can become pretty complicated, and that can be hard to manage alone. And it becomes even more difficult if these patients have trouble getting out to the grocery store or standing at the kitchen counter to chop up vegetables. So the program has dietitians who pick and choose pieces of different medical diets. So that could be low potassium or low sugar or low salt. And then they freeze those meals and deliver them once a week.
And could they quantify how much less healthcare one of those patients was using because they got that food?
Yeah, so participants who got the medically tailored meals, they had fewer trips to the ER, fewer rides in ambulances, and actually fewer inpatient admissions to the hospital as well. Hmm. And of course, that then translated to lower healthcare costs. So if you take away the cost of actually providing the program, the study found that those medically tailored meals were associated with about 15% lower healthcare costs.
Wow, interesting. So that must be compelling to hospitals, also the insurance industry. How are they responding?
Yeah, so I think that's the hope with doing more research on this idea that food can also be a part of preventive medicine, is that these programs could get more insurers to pay for it. So this particular program in the study, Community Servings, they've gotten a few insurers to cover their meals, but there's a hope that demonstrating that the meals could actually potentially lower healthcare costs might sway more insurers to get on board.
Well, you bring up an interesting idea that food itself can actually be a form of medicine.
Yeah, and I think it's not as mainstream of an idea as you might think. I think certainly this kind of program would require a shift in thinking, also in the healthcare community. And I think there are signs that that's already starting to happen. There are more than a dozen programs that are like this one around the country. And there are also, if you look, other efforts going on right now in the healthcare space to raise awareness about the idea that food could actually prevent disease rather than waiting to intervene when a disease actually happens. So I think another good example of that is that there's sort of a fresh focus on healthier school lunches. There are also some hospitals and clinics now that'll actually prescribe fresh produce.
Right.
You can pick up that produce at, like, there's a hospital in California that you can pick up produce on your way out of your medical appointment.
Well, it sounds great, but one of the challenges that I can see here is that controlling a diet is really difficult to do, even if you don't have a medical condition. Did researchers consider that at all? Even if the food is delivered to patients, you know, it's a lifestyle change.
Of course, yeah. I think it's a very difficult thing to do, especially if you have so many restrictions on your diet, if you have three or four factors that are going into the specially tailored diet. And I think the program tries to take some of those hurdles out of the equation, like you said, by delivering the meals, by planning them, by preparing them. They've actually even given people microwaves if they don't have access to one. So it's really easy to just like throw the meals in the microwave. And I think that's a critical aspect to make sure the diets stick. But certainly it's difficult. And in this particular study, the subset of patients they looked at, for the most part, stuck with the medical diets and stayed enrolled in the program. But I think if this were to be enacted on a larger scale, certainly that's a conversation we would have to have about how to actually make sure that participants stick to the diets.
All right. Megan Thielking, a reporter at STAT, thanks very much.
Thanks so much.
We've got a story about health and human recovery, but it begins in the animal kingdom. Many animals can repair their bodies when they get hurt. They can actually regenerate an entirely new limb, even parts of their heart and brain. Scientists are studying this ability, and they hope to harness it for humans. Paige Flager from WHYY's The Pulse reports.
Regeneration happens in species across every branch of the tree of life. But what creature is the best at it?
I'm a little bit hesitant to confer the prize onto only one animal.
That's Ellie Tanaka, a scientist at the Research Institute for Molecular Pathology in Vienna, Austria. She says it's hard to pick only one winner because of the range of regenerative capabilities.
One type of worm that's worked on by a lot of researchers now is called the flatworm, and that animal can regenerate its head. If you cut off its head, it can regenerate its tail, and it can regenerate a whole animal if you chop up the animal into about 300 pieces, and each piece can regenerate a whole animal.
That's an impressive skill, but that worm is a relatively simple organism. It doesn't have arms or legs or bones like salamanders. They can regrow their tail and their limbs.
They certainly cannot regenerate their head. But considering how complex salamanders are, it's pretty amazing that they can regenerate a fully functional limb with all the tissues inside.
She says that the animals that can do this have a kind of blueprint in their cells. A cell knows if it's part of the upper arm, part of the tail, or the leg. If an injury occurs, the cells near the injury start to multiply and become stem cells that form the rest of the limb, the tissues and the bones.
You can see a kind of miniature version of the limb forming, and then that miniature version of the limb continues to expand in size until it matches the size of the body.
So flatworms can do it, salamanders can do it, but this ability to regenerate is something that mammals, including ourselves, are pretty bad at. We can regenerate our skin to a certain extent, parts of our liver, and sometimes even our fingertips, but that's about it. That's part of the reason that scientists around the world are studying animals that successfully regenerate to figure out what molecular materials those animals use to make it happen and what order it needs to happen in.
So in a sense, we're trying to reverse engineer the process of regeneration. And in a way, it's like buying a piece of furniture from IKEA.
That's Ona Bloom, a professor at the Feinstein Institute for Medical Research, a nonprofit laboratory that's part of a healthcare network in New York.
First, you pick out the dresser you want to have, and that's the desired phenotype, as we say in science. And in our case, that's regeneration of a tissue.
To put that regeneration dresser together, you need the box of parts.
We're looking for the lists of ingredients that are important during regeneration.
And you also need the instruction manual that tells you what order to put the parts together in. Bloom and her team have been studying regeneration in an eel-like fish called the lamprey.
The adults are very spooky looking, I will say. They have a sucker mouth that they will attach to the outside of a fish and eat them from the outside in.
The lamprey can regenerate its spine, going from paralyzed to swimming again within months. And Bloom and her team just discovered the list of parts involved in that process. They compared that list to humans and other mammalian genomes and found that we have many of the same parts that lampreys use to regenerate. The findings were published in the online journal Scientific Reports and are particularly exciting because they open up the possibility that we might have the right ingredients to regenerate. What we don't have yet is the instruction manual. She explains it like this.
We're speaking the same language, but we might not have put the words together in the right sentence to get the same meaning yet. So that gives us hope that it's not something that we don't know how to do. It might be that we don't know how to get it done at the right time in the right place.
The next steps for her team will be to try and compare the list of molecular materials in the lamprey to other animals that are also good at regenerating their spinal cords. Once scientists have put together the lists of parts and the instruction manuals of enough of these regenerative animals, they're hoping they'll be closer to figuring out how to kickstart regenerative abilities in us, too. For Here and Now, I'm Paige Flager.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Lisa Mullins.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now.